Chapter 8. I had made the mistake of closing all the windows before I'd left, not anticipating that Maine would experience its first ever monsoon season. The trapped air had a damp, mildewed smell that brought to mind an antebellum mansion rotting away at the edge of some dismal swamp. When I turned on the light in the kitchen, a wolf spider the size of a half dollar skittered across the floor and disappeared into a crack beneath the baseboard. My plan was to clean myself up, pack a duffel with clothes appropriate to the bug-ridden month of June, and head for the North Woods. Charlie and Aura lived alongside a remote, unspoiled pond in easternmost Maine, where their only neighbors were black bears and moose. Maybe by the time I returned, the wolf spider would have moved on to happier hunting grounds, and the wallpaper would have stopped peeling in strips from the bathroom wall. I had accrued 3 days of comp time while investigating Wheelwright. The state required me to take it in lieu of cash. God forbid that I should ever be paid for the actual hours I worked. I sent messages to inform my coworkers that I would be away. I assured my supervisor, Captain Jock DeFord, that I was ready, willing, and able to return to duty should the need arise. I put my service weapon in the gun safe and removed my personal handgun and 3 magazines. It was a Beretta PX4 Storm Compact. With regret, I had retired my beloved Walther PPKS that had seen me through so many adventures. The little 380 lacked the stopping power I needed when dealing with charging moose and charged-up men. The Beretta was harder to conceal, but I rarely missed with it. Loading the magazines with hollow points, I gazed out my window at the leafless oaks. The nests of invasive moths looked like spun sugar in their bare branches. In a few years, some of these trees would be dead from the defoliating infestation. The phone rang. It was Tom Wheelwright. I didn't want to answer, but feared he would keep calling, perhaps even call Major Shorey if I didn't pick up. Captain Wheelwright? Tom, please! Even his voice projected manly self-confidence. It's better that we don't communicate except through established channels. Totally understand. Listen, I just got a call from an Air Force buddy of mine, Joe Fixico. He said he spoke with you yesterday. I have to give you an A+ for thoroughness, Mike. I didn't even realize he was living in Miami-Dade. Captain, we can't be having this conversation. No, I understand, but you need to know that Fixico has mental problems. Don't get me wrong, he was a hell of an electronic warfare officer, but he was in an automobile accident a while back. It did severe damage to his brain. He still thinks he's getting the job, the cocky SOB. Captain, I spoke with the women. He didn't miss a beat. Which women are you referring to? Captain Wheelwright, I am going to hang up now. Please don't call back or attempt to contact anyone else on the search panel. We will be in touch. 5 seconds after I hung up, I had my supervisor on the phone. I just got your email about heading out of town, said Jock DeFord. Is there something you forgot to add? It's Wheelwright. I read your report, he said. Those are serious allegations. I don't like it, but the major thinks we owe him a chance to defend his name. Jock, he just called me. What do you mean? I mean, I just hung up on him. He's gotten wind of the conversation I had with Fixico and is trying to control the damage. Aside from the call being completely inappropriate, there is no way in hell we can hire this guy. His application needs to be shit-canned immediately. He shouldn't have reached out to you. Agreed. Even allowing this to proceed risks blowback from the press. I think you're exaggerating, Mike. Because I understand the danger Wheelwright poses to our credibility. You need to make sure Shorey doesn't sway the hiring panel. I think you're selling the rest of us short. We're all on the same page about Wheelwright. Not Shorey. Pat is going to be Pat, but he doesn't have the purview to hire whoever he wants. There's nothing for you to worry about. That was easier said than done. When I was a teenager, the warden service had weathered one shitstorm after another. First, an instructor at the Advanced Warden Academy had been fired for hazing cadets with his own urine. Then, an undercover warden busted a well-liked fishing guide on some rinky-dink charges. The guide claimed entrapment, and the story somehow found its way into the Wall Street Journal. Afterward, all charges were dropped against the guide. The bad press had reached its peak 15 years earlier in a raid on a town along the New Brunswick border. An undercover warden investigator had disappeared somewhere around the village of St. Ignace and was presumed to have been murdered by the poaching gang he'd infiltrated. In the first hours of the house-to-house search, three residences had been burned to the ground. The fire had almost certainly been set by the man who'd killed the investigator, but the media, goaded on by opportunistic politicians, had accused the warden service of engaging in stormtrooper tactics. Those scandals had occurred before the advent of social media and the hashtag MeToo movement. I could guess what Twitter might do with a serial predator like Tom Wheelwright. Before I left home, I wrote an email to Danny. I knew she wouldn't see it until she finished qualifying at the range. She would have it in her head that I would be driving over to Western Maine to stay at her house. I wanted to prepare her for disappointment. And the situation with Charlie was too complicated to explain via a chain of text messages. We had been dating long distance for more than a year now. Door to door was a 2-hour drive, but the excitement of visiting her made it seem shorter. Danny was, in a word, fun. She was go, go, go. She liked racing snowmobiles across frozen lakes and speed hiking to the tops of 4,000-foot mountains. She had given me private lessons in Brazilian jiu-jitsu that always seemed to end in our having sex. Less successfully, she had tried to interest me in video games we could play against each other while physically apart. Mario Kart was her current favorite, but I couldn't get into them. I had always been an old soul. Alone at night, I preferred a good book. Danny's personal library consisted of her old textbooks and motivational guides by Stephen Covey and Anthony Robbins. In my email, I laid out the meager information I had about my mentor's sudden disappearance. "I know you'll understand," I wrote. "Charlie has been the closest thing I've ever had to a real father. I owe it to Aura to track him down." The old pilot had his faults. He could be reckless, scheming, secretive. He was a born actor who exaggerated his folksy Maine accent when it benefited him for a suspect to underestimate his intelligence. He had the corniest sense of humor. Nor had he handled Stacy's and my breakup with the grace for which I had hoped. And yet, he remained my hero. "I wish he talked more about his past," I continued. "It seems like everything I know about his history, from his childhood in the logging camps to his service in Vietnam, I had to pry out of him or hear secondhand. We'd known each other for years before he told me he'd been shot down and imprisoned in the Hanoi Hilton. How does someone not mention something like that?" God only knows what else he's done that he's never told me about. Still, in the 7 years we'd known each other, Charlie had conducted the equivalent of a PhD program in the flora and fauna of the Maine woods. He had taught me how to do my job, enforcing the state's laws, while staying true to my inner compass. Most importantly, he had instructed me in what it meant to be a man in a cultural moment when masculinity was presumed toxic until proven otherwise. "With luck, he'll be home by the time I get there, probably with a bouquet of flowers and some lame excuse for Aura. Same old Charlie." Even while I typed these words, I felt a hollowness in my chest. I could say that he was just being himself. But in running off without any explanation, Charlie had behaved like someone I didn't recognize. I was afraid, I realized. Afraid that in finding the man, I risked losing my respect for him. At 31, maybe I was too old to believe in heroes. But I needed Charlie Stevens to remain what he had always been, the best man I'd ever known. Chapter 9. Driving along Coastal Route 1 in the summer was one of my several visions of hell. The traffic was bumper to bumper where the road threaded through pedestrian-clogged villages. Then, on the straightaways, tourists passed one another like maniacs desperate to get to Acadia National Park where they could relax among the hundreds of thousands of people just like them. It took 2 hours, but I finally escaped the worst of it. Just past Ellsworth, the road opened, the speed limit rose, and soon I was cruising through miles of rolling blueberry barrens, the bushes already in full flower. It was as if I had entered not another county, but another nation. My second patrol district had been here in down east Maine. The assignment had felt like exile at first. Washington County was one of the poorest counties north of the Mason-Dixon line, and an early epicenter of the opioid pandemic that later devastated so much of rural America. It had taken time, but I had warmed to the luckless region, even came to love it after a fashion, the people especially, and had settled briefly in the county before fate announced it had different plans for me. When I crossed the bridge above Bad Little Falls and entered downtown Machias, I had the sensation of revisiting a place I'd known from a past life. Storefronts that had been vacant from my days as a patrol warden still had yellowed for lease signs in their dusty windows. Everyone was shopping at the three new dollar stores out on the strip, I'd heard. At last, I came to the dike. On the eastern side of the road was the salt water, still brackish from the river tumbling down the falls. On the western side were dozens of parking spaces and a guardrail separating the pavement from a well-traveled ATV trail. People in this part of the world took their four-wheelers to the convenience store to buy beer and cigarettes, the way people elsewhere used their cars for the same desperate errands. The flea market was bunched up at the north end. On this overcast afternoon, the bazaar consisted of a handful of tables and sheltered booths, plus the food truck that sold breakfast sandwiches made with apple cider donuts instead of English muffins. I backed my scout into one of the many empty spaces and stepped out into the afternoon steam bath. Aura's friend, the artist Carol Boyce, was an outsized woman in every way, large, lavish, and loud, who wore muumuus and used a paintbrush as a hair stick in her bun. She'd been an adjunct English professor at the University of Maine at Machias, but had taken up painting in retirement. Her watercolors hung from the tent, blurry depictions of lighthouses and smeared lupin fields. It was hard to discern if Carol was an impressionist or just had bad eyesight. She peered up at me when my shadow fell across her sketch pad. "I know you," she said with an undertone of accusation. "You're our dear departed game warden." "That makes me sound like I'm dead, Mrs. Boyce." She smelled of rose water. "I expect you're here on account of Aura Stevens." "How did you guess?" "You and Charlie were always as thick as thieves. She called me to ask about the strange vendor here the other day, the one who argued with her husband."
"Can you describe him?"
"He was but a ruin of a man."
"Could you be more specific?"
"It was the careless, powerful look he had, in spite of a lameness checking each step like the jerk of a chain."
I didn't realize she was reciting a quote until my vacant expression exposed me.
"Did you never read Ethan Frome, Warden?"
"In high school, I think." She slapped closed her sketch pad.
"It seemed to me that this man you're looking for had been in a pretty bad smash-up, the way he dragged himself around. I would say a motorcycle was involved based on the tattoos and the grungy affect. But you want specifics. He had a kerchief around his bald head and a scraggly beard, more gray than black, wore dungarees and a flannel shirt, no sleeves. He never removed his sunglasses, but they looked cheap, like the ones you might choose from a rack at the gas station."
Her detailed description made me wish more of my witnesses were visual artists.
"Did you catch his name?" "I went over to have a look at his wares and be sociable, as I always do, but he refused to introduce himself or even say where he was from. We're a community here on the dike. We have manors and moors. The things he had for sale seemed fishy, too, not the usual culch."
The term is Maine lingo for the knickknacks you find in attics and basements after an aged relative passes away. How so? It was an assortment of items you don't see for sale at souks like this. There was some taxidermy, but also an electric guitar, 3 mink coats, even an espresso maker. Who sells an espresso maker at a place like this? It sounds like the kinds of items you'd find in a pawn shop. That's exactly right. It was as if he were a pawnbroker. What about his vehicle? One of those cheap Plymouth minivans, the ones with the flaking paint on the hoods. The color was, or had been, cerulean blue. I take it you didn't see the license plate.
She lifted a Japanese hand fan from the table and began to wave it vigorously in the air.
I'm a watercolorist, not a state trooper. Did you happen to overhear any of Charlie's conversation with the stranger? The only part I heard was when Ethan Frome shouted at Charlie, "You can't take that, not without paying." Finally. Did Charlie say anything in response?
Yes. He said, "I've got your number."
The look on his face when he passed my table, I've never seen Charlie Stevens that mad before. Normally, I consider him to be a handsome man. Not all my female friends do, but this was the first time I remember thinking he looked ugly. Ugly with anger. Do you know what Charlie took from his table? She considered the question with real thoughtfulness. Whatever it was small enough to fit in his hand. I'm sorry to keep pressing you on this, Mrs. Boyce, but you said you looked at the items on this man's table. What did you see that might have fit in Charlie's hand? Earrings, watches, jackknives. My cell phone rang at that moment. I pulled aside my coat to reach for my back pocket. When I saw whose number it was, Major Shorey's, I let the call go to voicemail and turned back to the watercolorist.
He also had a badge, Carol Boyce said.
Excuse me?
He had a badge for sale. Seeing yours made me remember.
In reaching for my phone, I had exposed the badge clipped on my belt.
It was a game warden's, she said. Only smaller and tarnished. And it had a number on it.
Don't bother asking me what the number was. I just happened to have noticed because the digits were so clumsily engraved in the metal.
You've been extremely helpful, Mrs. Boyce. I wish there was something.
You could buy one of my paintings.
I waited to see if her deadpan would crack, only to realize she was completely serious. Happily, my phone chose that moment to ring again. It was Danny, calling presumably from the firing range.
Sorry, but I need to take this one, I said, already backing away. It's my girlfriend.
The artist waved her paper fan in the dead air.
A likely story.
You have perfect timing, I told Danny. I can never tell when you're being a wise ass. I'm serious. You rescued me from being forced to buy a painting by one of the least talented artists in Maine, and that's saying something.
Cars and trucks rumbled and roared past. I cupped my hand to my opposite ear to hear her better.
I got that long email you sent. I was looking forward to seeing you.
Of course you have to go up there to help.
Thanks for understanding, I said. Where are you?
At the Machias Dyke. I have a theory about what set Charlie off the other day. I gave her a quick rundown of everything Carol Boyce had told me.
You think it was an old warden badge? Danny asked.
That's my best guess. It's not illegal to sell those. They come up for sale on auction sites all the time.
Why would Charlie get pissed off about running across one?
I can think of two reasons, I said. The first is the stuff the guy was selling. It sounded like the kinds of things burglars steal from people's houses.
That's a real thing, Danny said. Thieves fencing their stolen merchandise at flea markets. It's especially bad in big cities. We're supposed to be on the lookout for anything that looks suspicious. What's the other reason?
Judging from how Charlie responded, I believe the badge belonged to someone he knew.
But warden badges don't have personal identification on them.
The really old badges did. They had district numbers engraved on the front.
So it might have been somebody Charlie knew as a young man?
Possibly.
What do you think Charlie meant when he told the guy, "I've got your number"?
Like he knew the creep was fencing stolen property? Maybe, but I'm guessing he meant something else. If you had been in Charlie's shoes, what would you have done to find out his identity? She sighed with embarrassment. Looked at his license plate. A person can't just find out who owns a vehicle by typing a license plate number into a website. You need help from a dispatcher, but that wouldn't be a problem for Charlie, who still has friends in law enforcement. That's another question for Aura, I guess. That's where you're headed next? Knowing Aura, she's going to insist I stay for dinner, which means I'll probably end up spending the night. I understand, she said. I miss you, babe. It's been a long week. Gulls chattered out on the flats, pecking for bloodworms in the acres of exposed mud. How did you shoot today? I asked. Not my best. My head is splitting. I think it's the flu. If you're sleeping at 6th Machias Lake tonight, who's taking care of Shadow? Logan Kronk. This is going to end with the wolf eating him. I would have laughed if it wasn't a real fear of mine. She became quiet again. Danny? You need to promise me something, Mike. You need to promise to keep in touch. I want to be your partner, not just your friend with benefits. I know you're trying to be honest and open with me, but it's not in your nature to ask for help. It was an accusation that had the problem of being true. I promise. Chapter 10. The Boondocks. The Willowas. The Backcountry. None of these terms properly describe just how deep Charlie and Aura lived in the woods. Late in life, they had built a house and a guest house on the shores of 6th Machias Lake, a body of water so remote and insignificant no one had ever constructed so much as a fishing camp there. Charlie's friend Nick Francis had told him that the Wabanakis, who had originally occupied all the land from Lake Champlain to Cape Breton Island, had named the lake Walchapakoosis, Little Puddle. The Stevenses might have relocated somewhere even more isolated if not for Aura's health problems, some of which were lingering after effects of the plane crash that had paralyzed her, others of which were part of the normal process of aging. Her husband seemed impervious to physical decline. For Aura's sake, they had been forced to build a gated road into the lake so they could drive her wheelchair-accessible van to hospitals and pharmacies. Charlie couldn't have been more pleased with his puddle. He wanted to spend his last years living somewhere off the edge of the map. He had a float plane and an ATV and a snowmobile. What more did he need? It was near dark when I finally left the logging road and turned onto the unmarked jeep trail that led to their hidden pond. A mile into the uncut forest, I reached the steel gate. I had memorized the combination of the padlock, but had no need of it. The gate was ajar. In my headlights, I saw tire prints, like the tracks of two rough-bellied snakes. They belonged to a heavy vehicle, a pickup, possibly an SUV. It had entered the property, but not yet exited. The gate made a terrific bang as I swung it shut behind me, loud enough to frighten off a woodcock that had been hiding in the alders nearby. It rocketed into the shadows with a flurry of wingbeats.
The house came into view slowly, not as a structure in itself, but as a row of illuminated rectangles where the first floor windows were.
As I emerged from the dense conifers surrounding the main building, I saw a black Ford Interceptor parked in the dooryard. The insignia of the Washington County Sheriff's Department reflected my high beams. When I was the local warden, I used to know all the police vehicles by their plate numbers, but that was years ago now. The longtime sheriff had lost her bid for re-election and had been replaced by her chief deputy, and there were many new faces in the department, all of them male. As I stepped down from the scout, the front door opened, throwing light down the ramp Charlie had built for Aura's wheelchair. The silhouette of a slight, almost delicate man appeared within the frame. He wore a chocolate-brown uniform and a duty belt laden with a gun, taser, and all the other tools of the law enforcement trade. I removed the badge from my belt and held it out as I advanced on the house.
Mike Bowditch, Warden Service Investigator. What's going on here? That's what I'm trying to ascertain, sir.
He was slender, even wearing a bulky ballistic vest. He had a wisp of a mustache, like a teenager trying to grow one for the first time, and a hairline that started 2 inches above his eyebrows. The name on his chest was Young, which seemed so appropriate that part of me wondered if I was being pranked. Aura wheeled her chair into the lighted room behind the cop.
Oh, Mike, the deputy says Charlie assaulted a man in Holton.
That's insane.
There's a man in the hospital who swears it was Mr. Stevens, said Deputy Young.
He had a way of pushing his voice lower into his diaphragm. Rookies are so quick to play at being tough guys. I knew this from hard personal experience.
How long have you been on the force, Young?
4 months.
Been to the academy yet?
I'm going next term. How are these questions relevant, sir?
Clearly you haven't met Warden Stevens. If you had, you'd know this man's accusations are bullshit.
I'd prefer to hear that from the warden himself. You wouldn't happen to know where he is, would you?
Can you close the doors, please, dears? Said Aura. The bugs are coming in.
Aura Stevens's green eyes were somehow even paler than those of her daughter. She had the high cheekbones of a professional model, smooth skin that might have belonged to a woman half her age, and snow-white hair pushed back from her face. She wore a mint-green blouse and a hand-knitted blanket over her legs. White tennis shoes peeked out on the footrests of her wheelchair.
What's the name of the man who's accusing Warden Stevens of assault? I asked.
John Smith.
You're sure it's not John Doe?
But the deputy didn't catch the sarcasm in my voice.
What does he say happened?
Young removed a mobile phone from his pocket and brought up a photograph of a bruised and bandaged man. He had a shaved skull, a scraggly beard, and deeply set eyes. He looked like he'd stepped face first into a bus.
Mr. Smith says Warden Stevens threatened him 3 days ago at his booth at the Machias Dyke. Then yesterday morning he says he opened the door of his residence in Island Falls to find Warden Stevens waiting. In Mr. Smith's statement he says the warden proceeded to assault him.
That's bullshit.
Mrs. Stevens has verified that her husband and Mr. Smith quarreled. I don't suppose you have any idea what could have provoked their argument, ma'am?
Aura had already been too candid with the deputy, but her nature was to trust people until they proved undeserving of it. I needed to intervene.
He was selling taxidermy mounts in violation of the U.S. Migratory Bird Treaty Act.
It was a lie, but a plausible one. The deputy had gentle eyes for a law enforcement officer, but they were not unintelligent eyes.
Why did he pursue Mr. Smith all the way to his home in Island Falls?
He wanted to be certain before he called the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He wanted to give the guy a chance to avoid being charged with a felony. How easily lies came to me now.
So you spoke with Warden Stevens?
I didn't need to, because I know his character. Your sheriff does too.
I can't believe he dignified the accusation by sending you all the way out here, Young.
I affected an air of indignation that I didn't entirely feel.
Charlie Stevens is a war hero and decorated career warden. If anyone deserves the benefit of the doubt, it's him.
Mr. Smith hired a lawyer. He's pushing us to bring charges.
I see.
The sheriff wanted to get Warden Stevens' side of the story before he talks to the district attorney, but Mrs. Stevens says she doesn't know where her husband is.
He's out of cell phone range is all.
Where?
Pick a spot on the map of the North Woods. Your guess is as good as mine. He hitched his thumbs in his ballistic vest to relieve some of the weight.
So he's camping then?
Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Aura fidgeting. She disapproved of these falsehoods.
Are you asking me to find him for you? I said.
Young might have been a rookie, but he was no fool.
No, sir. I am not asking you to do anything. But if we can't locate Warden Stevens, it's a problem for us and for him. If I may speak freely, sir, no one wants to request a warrant for Warden Stevens. You really need to convince him to come forward.
I'll see what I can do.
I'd appreciate that, sir. I know you by reputation. People still talk about what a badass you were. I'm wondering if you can answer a question for me, unrelated to what we've been discussing, if I can.
The police academy. Is it really as tough as the guys say it is?
Not as tough as when I was there, I've heard.
Too bad.
I was looking to test myself. The job will do that. It will test you every day and twice on Saturday nights. Tell the sheriff I'll find Charlie Stevens. He just needs to stall the DA. The deputy tipped his hat to Aura and shook hands with me. He was a respectful kid. I liked him, mustache and all. But after the red taillights of his cruiser disappeared into the trees, I turned to Aura. The way he kept calling me sir made me feel like someone's great uncle. Aging is one of those things you can't explain to people, she said, no matter how hard you try. They need to go through it themselves. Please come into the living room, Mike.
The house was clean but cluttered in the fashion of many Northwoods camps. Charlie's 3 decades as a game warden meant there was an abundance of taxidermy. Deer mounts on the walls, a moose head over the fireplace, several bearskin rugs. The room resembled the main wing of a natural history museum. The smell of the lake drifted in through the window screens, although I couldn't see the water in the darkness. Across the pond, a barrel owl called, "Who cooks for you?" It made me remember the night I'd met Aura at their old camp. Charlie had called in owls with his expert imitations.
I'm scared, Mike.
I took her cold hands in mine. That jackass Smith is just looking for a quick and easy payout. I am pretty sure he's been selling stolen merchandise at these pop-up flea markets. The DA is just going through the motions. Charlie never laid a hand on the man.
She made a faint noise in the back of her throat. Her green gaze drifted from me. Then she removed her hands from mine and tucked them beneath the blanket. From this reaction, I was fairly certain that Aura Stevens believed her husband had committed the violent act of which he stood accused.
Chapter 11. Despite my protests, she insisted on making me dinner, grilled salmon with asparagus. Aura and Charlie were as far from hippies as I could imagine. I doubt that either of them could have named a song by the Grateful Dead, but they had always lived off the land. The Stevenses kept a kitchen garden and had foraged together for mushrooms, berries, and wild greens before her accident. These days, it was Charlie's job to gather the free-growing groceries and pack their freezers with the moose, deer, and ducks he shot. While Aura prepared our meal, the kitchen had been built to accommodate her wheelchair, I sampled Charlie's homemade beer. Brewing was his newest hobby, and the so-called IPA was so bitter it was barely drinkable.
Because we can't grow hops here, Charlie used yarrow, Aura explained. Or maybe mugwort. The funny thing is, he doesn't even drink beer.
It showed.
Before we start, she said, how is Stacy?
Did she tell you about what happened last night?
No, I haven't heard from her today.
We had an adventure in the Everglades. A Burmese python was involved.
Tell me.
Right now, I think we should talk about Charlie, I said. I stopped at the dike on my way here. Carol Boyce told me she overheard what Charlie and Smith were arguing about. She said it was a badge. He took it from the table without paying. It had numbers on the bottom, Carol said. I'd hoped the news would provoke a response, but she gazed at me with expectation, waiting for more. Is there any warden from Charlie's past whom he had a special connection with, either a friend or a mentor, whose badge this could have been?
Not if it was an antique. I suppose it might have belonged to one of the old-timers who were with the Bureau when he started. Charlie might have recognized the number, but unless he had reason to believe it was stolen, I can't imagine why he would have reacted that way. Everything about Charlie's actions seemed out of character. The public blow-up, the mysterious disappearance, the accusation leveled by Smith. I felt like we were talking about a violent stranger and not the wise, even-tempered man I considered a surrogate father. What about his cell phone?
I said. I've called the number and sent him texts and emails, but I haven't gotten a response.
So he took it with him?
He always does. Why?
The sense I am getting is that wherever Charlie is going, he doesn't want to be tracked. If he left his mobile phone here, I haven't come across it.
Can I pour you some more coffee, dear? I'd appreciate that, I said.
I also wonder if I might use your computer.
Charlie cleared the browser search history.
I already checked.
More than most people their ages, the Stevenses were determined not to be left behind by new technology.
Does he do that often?
Never.
Ora told me that Charlie's password was O1 Bird Dog, after the light aircraft he had flown during the Vietnam War. Bird dogs were small surveillance planes that often skipped just above the treetops within easy range of enemy fire. The North Vietnamese Army didn't need a shoulder-fired missile to take down a bird dog. The weapon that had downed Charlie's plane was an AK-47. Ora was in the kitchen cleaning up. She had sensed that I didn't want her watching over my shoulder. The locator app probably wouldn't even function.
The phone might be out of power.
It might be beyond the reach of a cellular signal. Or Charlie might have removed the SIM card that could be used to trace the phone's physical location. A map of 6th Machias Lake appeared instantly on the screen. An icon indicated the location of Charlie's phone. At first, it seemed to be inside the house. Only when I zoomed in did I see that the phone was pictured at the edge of the lake. Charlie's float plane. In her wheelchair, Ora would have been unable to check the Cessna herself. I shut down the machine and returned to the kitchen, where she was drying the last plate with a rag. I didn't want to tell her about my discovery until I could assess the situation firsthand.
I'm going to take a walk to clear my head.
You'll be eaten alive. The black flies and mosquitoes are especially bad this year on account of the wet spring we had.
Not as bad as the Everglades, I expect.
That's just what Stacy says.
The mention of her daughter caused a moment of awkwardness. She asked if I needed a flashlight. I showed her the Surefire I carried in my pocket. I hadn't taken more than 2 steps outside before the first mosquito jabbed her needle into my neck. But at least I could safely assume this one wasn't carrying malaria. The haze of clouds concealed the precise location of the waxing moon, but the night wasn't entirely dark. I slid my flashlight into my pocket and let my night vision guide me down the boardwalk to the lake. Trout were rising to hatching insects. The fish made circles that rippled outward across the smooth surface. The newly emerged mayflies were Hexagenia limbata, and they were 3 inches long with greenish wings. I had worked as a fishing guide and had loved taking clients out at night for the hex hatch. Charlie kept his float plane, a red and white skyhawk, tied to the dock beside the boathouse. I pulled myself up by one of the struts and ducked to keep from knocking my head against the wing. I was correct in my assumption that he had left the door of the aircraft unlocked. As I entered the familiar cabin, the locus of so many of our adventures together, the plane rocked gently on the surface of the lake. I shined the flashlight around the cockpit and found the phone sitting atop the pilot's seat. Beneath it was a sealed envelope with my name on it, and another addressed to Ora. I tore mine open.
Dear Mike, I expect this makes no sense to you, my going off like a thief in the night. You think I'm cruel for leaving Ora to wonder and worry. Trust me, I had no choice. For one, I may be a fool about my suspicions. I won't know for certain until I talk to some folks I hope never to meet again. My fear is that I made the worst mistake a man can make in this life. If so, it means there's someone out there who's kept quiet all these years, waiting for me to wise up to my foolishness. A man of patience and guile. He's been expecting me, I fear, and taken precautions.
You can't put Aura or the girls in danger of his retribution. Chances are I'll be back before I'm missed, in which case you won't have to give Aura the other letter I've left. But if I'm not back, it'll mean I'm beyond anyone's ability to find, and your searching may only deliver you into the grasp of the same man who killed me. Instead, I hope you will forsake revenge and destroy these notes. Let my family remember me as the man I tried to be after my moment of weakness. I know you well enough to reckon that you won't heed my words of caution, which is why I am leaving you in the dark, too. I will cover my trail to keep you from following, but I fear I may have taught you too well. I love you, son. Don't come after me. Charlie. When I'd finished, I felt an inner heaviness, like a weight upon my soul, because I understood that this document might effectively be my friend's last testament. Chapter 12. When I returned to the house, I found Aura parked under a standing lamp. A glass filled with amber liquid and ice cubes rested within reach on a small table. A whiskey and soda was her nightly indulgence. She looked up from the book she was reading, a biography of the photographer Margaret Burke White. "You look positively bloodless," she said, peering at me above her reading glasses. "Did the mosquitoes drink you dry?" My voice didn't want to leave my throat. "They were pretty bad." "What did you find out there?" "Nothing that tells me where he went." I was using the truth to mislead her. I hoped my shame didn't show in my expression and give away the secret. If it did, she was too polite to press the matter. Instead, she smiled that incandescent smile of hers. "I hope you're staying the night." "It's been a long day." "I keep forgetting that you woke up this morning in Florida. It's no wonder you look exhausted. Well, your room's all made up." "My room." She was referring to the guest cabin that Stacy had lived in years earlier, when she was newly returned to Maine and working as a wildlife biologist, back before she and I had started dating. I probably stayed there more than anyone else now, but I still felt uncomfortable when Aura called the place mine. "There's something I want to show you before you go," she said. I hadn't noticed the cigar box on the table beside her until she lifted it with both hands. Long ago, maybe on the occasion of the birth of one of their two daughters, someone had presented Charlie with a box of white owls. I raised the lid. Inside was a rattling collection of medals. I counted 3 purple hearts, 2 legions of merit, a silver star, a distinguished flying cross, a prisoner of war medal, and a distinguished service cross, which he had somehow never mentioned having received. It was only the second highest award given out by the U.S. military. He never told me he'd won all of these. Aura lowered her glass of whiskey. "One isn't the word Charlie would have used. He keeps that box in the closet with his shoeshine kit. I can't remember the last time he took it out. While you were outside after you'd asked me about his past, I went to fetch it. I found this inside with the medals." From the pocket of her sweater, she produced a yellow Polaroid photograph. It showed a man who looked to be half bear. His hair was long and black, and his beard grew high up on his cheeks. His dark eyes were narrowed, and his chapped lip was curled. The expression could only be described as murderous. "Who is this?" "I have no idea. A friend from the army? No friend of Charlie's could look that hateful. Why would he keep this picture with his military decorations?" "I don't know," she said. "But my husband has always had conflicted feelings on the accolades he's received. I'm not sure he cares about medals and honors, but they're part of his story, and Charlie doesn't believe in airbrushing history. Look on the back."
I flipped over the snapshot and saw, in Charlie's familiar bold hand, these words. In battle. In the forest. At the precipice in the mountains. On the dark great sea. In the midst of javelins and arrows. In sleep. In confusion. In the depths of shame. The good deeds a man has done before defend him. I looked it up online, Aura said. It's from the Bhagavad Gita. Despite having only a junior high education, the old pilot was a secret autodidact who read widely, especially history, and liked to conceal his learning beneath his folksy affect. Nevertheless, I couldn't imagine the man quoting Sanskrit scripture. What do you think it means? I asked. I don't know. Can I take this photo with me? Of course. When I leaned down to kiss her cheek, she whispered, You'll find him, won't you? I will. Afterward, I made my way down the boardwalk between the main building and the guest house. The entire property was connected by these raised ramps so that Aura could wheel herself to the woodshed to get kindling for the stove, or even to the dock to cast white wolf flies to those trout I had seen rising. The cabin had electricity provided by solar panels on the south-facing roof, but I lighted the propane lanterns mounted on the walls, in part because I preferred the smell and the white-hot intensity of their illumination. I tossed my duffel on the bed and set the snapshot of the were-bear on the bureau. In all likelihood, the monstrous man had nothing to do with the current crisis, but I would keep this photograph anyway, in the hope of finding someone who could identify him. If nothing else, I needed to satisfy my curiosity about who he was. It hadn't escaped my notice that in his letter, Charlie hadn't mentioned the badge that had precipitated his disappearance. The omission had been deliberate because he knew it was a clue that I would follow. The warden service had stopped stamping identification numbers on its badges long before Charlie had even joined the bureau. Whose could it have been? Charlie had never mentioned a fellow officer from that era who had been a mentor to him. A letter, then. What could it tell me? I turned up the gas fueling the lamp beside the bed. In the hissing white glow, I examined the text for hidden meanings. I may be a fool about my suspicions. I won't know for certain until I talk to some folks I hoped never to meet again. As I'd suspected, whatever this was about had happened years earlier before Charlie and I had become friends. My fear is that I made the worst mistake a man can make in this life. The worst mistake a man can make could mean only one thing to the Charlie Stevens I knew, killing another human being. As a reconnaissance pilot in Vietnam, he wouldn't have engaged in direct combat, but he had called in the locations of enemy forces who would then have been subjected to airstrikes and other bombardments. Depending upon how susceptible he was to guilt, a bird dog pilot could feel as if he had the blood of thousands on his hands. There might also have been another wartime incident of which I was unaware, something that had happened after Charlie had been shot down. He seldom spoke of the experience, but he had spent nearly a year in Hoa Lo Prison, better known as the Hanoi Hilton, where one of his fellow inmates was a future United States senator and presidential candidate. Torture had left him with burns and rope scars. He had suffered a broken leg in the crash that had healed badly and yet rarely revealed itself. The only time he showed any sign of a limp was in bitterly cold weather, after having already hiked miles across difficult terrain. I was falling down a rabbit hole, I realized. My recent investigation of Captain Wheelwright had me focused on the sins of military men, but this mystery had all started with the game warden's badge. I needed to concentrate on Charlie's life in Maine.
During the course of his long career as a law enforcement officer, he had never killed another human being. Of that, I was close to certain. Forget what you've read in novels and watched on television. In real life, cops don't respect other cops who are quick to pull a trigger. In just 7 years, I had already acquired a reputation for being a gunfighter. Charlie had made it abundantly clear that having a high death count was not something of which I should be proud. Just the opposite, in fact. I returned to the letter. It means there's a man out there who's kept quiet all these years waiting for me to wise up to my foolishness. A man of patience and guile. He's been expecting me, I fear, and taken precautions. I can't put Aura or the girls in danger of his retribution. These sentences suggested that finding this badge had led Charlie to conclude he might have been duped. The notion seemed outlandish to me. But even though I had yet to meet a criminal mastermind, it didn't mean they didn't exist. Obviously, Charlie had his suspicions. He would be extra careful in confronting anyone he suspected might have gotten away with murder. I know you well enough to reckon that you won't heed my words of caution. Damned right. There was nothing he could do to stop me. Which is why I am leaving you in the dark, too. I will cover my trail to keep you from following, but I fear I may have taught you too well. Charlie needed my help, but he didn't want to be responsible for placing me in danger. Why else leave a letter worded this way if he didn't hope I would disobey his instructions? Why not give me the name of the man or men he suspected? Wouldn't it be more dangerous for me to wander blindly into the crosshairs of a masterful killer? Who are you, Charlie? What have you done? What do you require me to do? Lying atop the bedspread in the humid dark, smelling the lake alive with new life, I considered these questions. My younger self had believed fiercely in the idea that we can never truly know another human being, that we are solipsistic creatures doomed to brief, lonely existences. Experience had taught me that we can only escape our private prisons by trusting and giving ourselves to others. Now, for the first time in years, I found myself seeing the face of someone I loved in my mind's eye and wondering about the stranger behind the mask. Chapter 13. I awakened after dawn to the singing of a morning warbler outside my window. Millions of Americans have heard this species of woodland bird, but will never see one. The warbler's recorded song is used by television sound engineers when they need background effects suggestive of peaceful mornings and idyllic golf courses. Hear a bird singing in a commercial? Odds are it's a morning warbler. The lonesome bird was still singing his heart out weeks after he should have been settling down to nest. The poor little guy hadn't found a mate. I put on a Henley t-shirt and jeans, laced up my bean boots, stripped the bed, and threw my duffel over my shoulder. I stepped outside into another drowsy morning. The tree trunks were wet as if with perspiration. The earthy smell of leaf mold and crumbling stumps rose from the forest floor.
Orange fungi erupted from the wounds in the bark of the rotted logs.
As I made my way up the ramp toward the house, I caught the scent of frying donuts coming from the kitchen. I began to salivate like my wolf back home. I poured myself a mug of coffee and sat down at the table while Aura dusted the donuts with cinnamon and powdered sugar.
"Stacy called late last night,"
she remarked with a casualness that sounded forced.
"She said you skipped out on her without saying goodbye."
"I was at her house getting cleaned up when you called me about Charlie. She thought you must have had a crisis of conscience about Danny." "True enough. Did you tell her I was here?" "It would have meant telling her about her father, and she already sensed something was wrong.
She said she was worried about him and didn't know why. I lied and told her he was off on a camping trip, but I know she didn't believe me. Despite having been raised in a Catholic household, I had always been a skeptic when it came to paranormal matters. Then I'd met Aura and Stacy Stevens.
Their feelings about distant events had often turned out to be true far more frequently than could have been predicted by random chance.
Stacy shares her mother's ESP. You make it sound supernatural that we're emotionally connected. I'm not sure it isn't. While she prepared the rest of our breakfast, strawberries and home-baked granola, I thought of the other envelope Charlie had left me, the letter to his wife. I would keep it secret for the time being. He intended it to be shared only in the event of his death. I hated myself for not telling her about it. What is your plan? She asked. I think I'll pay a visit to John Smith and find out how he really got his injuries. Are you sure that's a wise idea? Of course it isn't. Stop in to see Nick Francis on your way north. You'll be passing through the reservation anyway. Maybe he knows more than he's saying. You told me you'd already spoken with Nick, but I'm not Mike Bowditch. It was the first time since I'd arrived that I'd seen playfulness in those beautiful eyes. The good humor lasted only an instant. Half an hour later, I was driving northeast along the Stud Mill Road, a gravel-strewn highway for logging trucks that cuts through the heart of the woods from the border crossing at Callis to the outskirts of Bangor. 18-wheelers loaded with unskinned tree trunks barreled along at terrific speeds, heedless of deer, moose, or other motorists. I emerged into the little hamlet of Grand Lake Stream with my scout plastered with mud kicked up by their massive wheels. I had made my home in this village once, during a hiatus in my service as a game warden. I had worked briefly as a commercial fishing guide, taking sports out onto Big Lake and the St. Croix River to catch salmon, trout, and smallmouth bass. I had not been unhappy. It was in Grand Lake Stream that I had asked Stacy out on our first date, and she had said yes. But the general store had changed owners twice since I had been away. Old-time residents had died. Houses had been sold to people whose names I didn't recognize. I kept driving until I had entered Indian Township. According to the most recent census, just 600 or so people live there now. They and 3,000 of their relatives, scattered about the state, were all that was left of the great Passamaquoddy Nation. The Passamaquoddy were one of 5 Native American tribes in Maine, the others being the Penobscots, the Maliseets, the Abenaki, and the Mi'kmaqs. Like American Indians elsewhere, they had not prospered during the centuries since Europeans built their first blockhouses on the continent. I couldn't help but think of my visit to the Miccosukee restaurant. In a single day, I had left one pocket of Indian country for another. Peter Dana Point, named for one of their most venerated leaders, jutted into the narrows between Long and Big Lakes. The road passed through unbroken forest for a half mile before it transformed into a strip of identical houses. These were all brick, all one story, and most had cluttered yards. Near the tip of the point was a ball field and a school and some buildings designed by architects who specialize in post offices and other nondescript governmental structures. Every person I passed, every child playing in a yard, every middle-aged man riding a bicycle, every group of women smoking on a porch, watched me drive past with interest. The reservation drew few non-Indian sightseers.
What was there to see?
Nick Francis lived on Pitt Row, a road named for its defining feature, a gravel excavation at the terminus. I pulled into his dooryard and turned off the engine. The home boasted a fantastic flower garden, bright with still-blooming purple lupins, orange poppies, pink azaleas, and white peonies. Someone in the Francis household had a wicked green thumb. Nick's property also had its share of yard art.
the term Mainers use for the random items that can accumulate outside houses. In addition to the usual ATVs, snowmobiles, and old appliances, there were half a dozen canoes, including several made by the owner of the house. Nick's birch bark designs were not works of art or faithful renditions of his people's historic watercraft, but they were impressive canoes nonetheless. I didn't know Francis well. Our only interactions had been through Charlie, but I knew that Nick had been a tribal game warden during the same period when my friend had patrolled the forests around the res. Later, he had become police chief, and later still, tribal governor, before some sort of scandal, there had been the suggestion of self-dealing, had led to crushing electoral defeat. "If Nick Francis was padding his pocket, then I am the Queen of Sheba," Charlie had remarked when the news broke. The two men were what Wheelwright and Fixico should have been, it occurred to me. Men from different cultures who had walked through fire for each other and would do so again. There was something infinitely hopeful in their unbreakable friendship. That said, I was unsure how I would be received by the retired tribal governor. White people rarely drove out to the point, and not all who did came with friendly intentions. Like the rest of Down East Maine, the reservation was in the grip of the opioid epidemic. Most of the worst dealers were whites, or at least they had been when I was stationed in the area. The front door opened as I mounted the stairs. A girl stood before me. Nick's granddaughter? He was a longtime widower who had lost his wife when she was young and had never remarried. Charlie told me he had raised his son and daughters himself. I guessed the girl to be around 13, although I am a poor judge of children's ages. She was pencil-thin with a round face, wide-set eyes, and hair shaved on one side of her head and long on the other. She was wearing a hoodie, denim cutoffs, and flip-flops. "Good morning," I said.
"Yeah?"
she said, forming the word around a mouthful of chewing gum. "I'm hoping to speak with Governor Francis. Is he at home?"
"Governor? He ain't been that in a while. What you want him for?"
"I'm a friend of a friend, Charlie Stevens. My name's Mike Bowditch."
"I'm Molly."
Her mobile eyes narrowed in recognition.
"Wait a second. I know you. You used to be the warden out on the lake. You checked our boat for life vests once. Wrote my pa a ticket. He tore it up and spat in your face."
The man in question was Nick's son and namesake, a troubled soul whose temper only worsened with every alcoholic beverage he consumed, and it wasn't unusual for him to drink a dozen twisted teas a day. He had claimed not to recognize my authority to write him a citation, even though I had stopped his pontoon party boat in Musquash Bay, outside Passamaquoddy waters.
"I remember that day well." She cracked her gum. "My pa's an asshole. I'm surprised you didn't shoot him when he ripped up that ticket and threw it into the lake."
We tried to avoid using lethal force in littering cases. She smiled wide enough for me to identify the color of her gum as purple.
"It would have saved us some trouble. He ran off on us a few years back. Met a Maliseet girl at the powwow on Indian Island. That's where my gramp is, up north trying to get money out of my dad."
"North where?"
"Holton. The Maliseet ain't got a res of their own. They got screwed out of one by you people."
I absorbed the blow. Because what was there to say? White people haven't treated the Passamaquoddies very well either. She scratched the stubble side of her hairdo. She moved her gum around the inside of her mouth. I had scored 0 points with that one. I offered my best smile.
"You wouldn't have a number for your grandfather?"
Molly Francis sighed and fished a bedazzled phone out of the kangaroo pocket of her hoodie. She asked for my number and sent me her grandfather's contact information.
"He might not be in a good mood," she said. "Gramp's a good man, but my pa brings out the beast in him. By the way, it ain't Passamaquoddies. It's Passamaquoddy. Plural.
The S is something you whites added for us.
Chapter 14. From Indian Township, I followed U.S. Route 1 north. The road paralleled the international boundary with Canada, and at certain crossroads there were signs pointing east toward official crossings. I passed more than one white and green Border Patrol vehicle. I wondered if any of the agents had come from the neon streets of Miami. Did they consider their main assignments exiles or escapes from the front lines of the immigration wars? After a while, the pine woods gave way to hardscrabble farms that had never been prosperous. The thin glacial soil was too poor for crops to thrive. Most of the pastures hadn't been grazed in ages. In the abandoned apple orchards, the blossoms had fallen, and the trees looked like they had piles of snow beneath them. In the fly-specked town of Orient, I passed a trailer with a no-trespassing sign and a Confederate flag flying from a jutting broomstick repurposed as a flagpole. The property itself seemed to consist of nothing but the ancient mobile home and a yard landmined with dog piles. Why were the owners of shitholes the most belligerent about keeping strangers off their precious land? Sadly, the sight of the stars and bars flying proudly in Maine, the heart of the Union, had ceased to shock me. John Smith had an unlisted address, of course. Luckily, a dispatcher at the Regional Communications Center in Holton owed me a favor. I had cut her teenage son some slack on a poaching charge. He was a good kid who had fallen in with backwoods delinquents. I typed the address the dispatcher gave me into my GPS and was surprised to discover that John Smith owned waterfront property. Given the description I'd gotten of the two-bit fence, I had assumed he dwelled on some dirty, dead-end road. Not that Hook Lake was considered a posh body of water, but lakeside houses in Maine don't come cheap, and even the ones that have been passed down over generations are freighted with crushing tax burdens, requiring income streams rarely achievable by men who dealt antiques at flea markets. From Holton, I sped west through a picturesque countryside utterly unlike the croft land I had just left. Here were great prosperous farms, grand old homesteads with majestic oaks and elms shading the front yards. Many of them had signs advertising their produce and meat as organically raised and free of genetically modified organisms. How quickly one Maine could become another. After a few minutes, I found the lake road. The clouds remained unbroken with no chinks of sunlight between them, and I had the feeling the drizzle might begin any second. I caught sight of water shimmering like hammered tin through the leaves of the maples. I eased my foot off the gas. The house was the second of three cottages built on lots that were longer than they were wide. The developer had marked out the property lines to maximize access to the water. In the paved drive of Smith's residence was parked a dented van that matched Carol Boyce's description. I pulled in behind it so our bumpers kissed. In the neighboring cottage, a white-haired man peeked out of his garage. He had the physique of someone who swam 2 miles every morning. He was wearing white short shorts and a lemon tank top. His deeply tanned skin shone with old-fashioned suntan oil, not the UV-blocking kind. "Good morning," I said. He chuckled mysteriously and made his way down the hill to his dock. I strode up the front steps and pushed the glowing doorbell. I heard a muted chime inside the house, but no footfalls. I pushed the button again and waited, this time for a full 30 seconds. Smith could be passed out in there, drugged or drunk. A warm breeze stirred the leaves of the aspens planted around the property. Another low-pressure front moving in from the south, the threat of afternoon thunderstorms. I backed away from the doorstep to see if I was being watched from one of the windows, but there were no signs of life. The old neighbor had returned to the garage for a life vest. He still wore the same expression of ironical amusement.
"Did you come here to kick the crap out of him, too?"
he asked in an accent I associated with Martin Scorsese movies.
"No."
"Shame."
Just then I thought I heard a screen door closing in the back of the house. It wasn't a sharp bang, more like a metallic tap. Then thudding noises that sounded like a man with a wooden leg running down a wooden dock.
"That's him getting away," said the tanned old man.
Moments later, I heard the unmistakable noise of someone pulling the cord on an outboard motor. I took off down the hill, rounding the corner of the building just as the engine sparked to life. Smith was seated in the stern of a battered, square-bowed aluminum boat. His hairy face was bruised and bandaged. He was wearing a flapping bathrobe over board trunks. His chest and lanky arms were mottled with tattoos. He turned the throttle, gunning the engine, but in his haste he had forgotten to untie the stern line from the cleat. The sudden acceleration brought the boat up short. The bow rose almost vertically from the water, but the rope didn't snap. By now I had reached the dock.
"Police! Stop!"
As the boat swung around like a dog testing the length of its lead, Smith lifted the prop from the water. The screw continued to spin. The rope stretched in a straight line to the transom of the boat. Gas fumes boiled blue in the air.
"Police! Cut the engine!"
Panicked, Smith glanced around the boat in search of some edged tool to cut the line. In doing so, he let go of the outboard. The weight of the engine dropped the propeller back into the lake. The spinning screw threw up a rooster tail.
"Mr. Smith, I just want to talk!"
The last thing I expected was for him to pull a handgun. He must have had it hidden in the pocket of his robe. He pointed the barrel at me from a distance of 5 yards. I heard the shot just before I dove into the lake.